Good morning. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I almost forgot that part. That's very important. So the title of this talk is The End of Life as We Know It. And the title comes from a lot of places. I remember it from years ago, from video games and science fiction movies, scenarios intended to scare people. Anger them, maybe motivate them to behave in a certain way to avoid such a cruel fate. Some people enjoy being frightened. I don't particularly. I have lots of things to be afraid of, I think, and had enough fear in my life. The doomsday events varied from alien invasions to asteroids or comets hitting the Earth, plagues, famines, other disasters, not to mention nuclear war and the demonizing of various political enemies. We still have a lot of that going on. The phrase was common enough that it came easily to mind when I read this book, The Ends of the World, by Peter Bannon. It talks about volcanic apocalypses, lethal oceans, and our quest to understand the Earth's past mass extinctions. So he's looking at the previous five mass extinctions on the Earth, taking us through geological time to paint a picture of these times, these various end times. He's looking at the whole geological record. He goes on his trip and he talks to all these different scientists around the country and looks at a lot of the fossil records and so on. So here are the events, starting from the earliest and moving to the latest. And I apologize in advance if I'm pronouncing things wrong. I didn't look up the pronunciation, I'm guessing. So 445 million years ago was the end Ordovician, with 86% of all species going extinct. 374 and 359 million years ago was the late Devonian, with 75% of species extinct. 252 million years ago was the end Permian, with 96% of species going extinct, which one scientist characterized as the worst thing that happened in the history of life on Earth. 201 million years ago was the end Triassic, with 80% of species extinct. And 66 million years ago was the end Cretaceous, with 76% of species, which included the dinosaurs, going extinct. When I looked at this timeline, the 96% figure of the end Permian immediately stuck out for me. Whoa, that's major, I thought. And it was. It took the Earth 10 or 20 million years to begin to recover from that one. Here are a few things. I'd love to share the whole book with you. It's fascinating. But here's a couple of things I took away from his descriptions. The carbon cycle is always a major contributor to mass extinction. When it gets out of whack, conditions change and things start to die. At one point, we had tropical weather at the poles, with the equator being basically uninhabitable. Most oceans were lethally hot, making it impossible for fish to survive. The continents have rearranged themselves several times throughout geologic time. Those of you who have looked at some of these maps, it's pretty bizarre how they just sort of move around and they come apart and they come back together and various things. At the time of the end Permian, we had Pangaea, which is a huge supercontinent. Basically, all of them were together in one big mass. And most of its interior was a dry wasteland, because its coastlines were few and limited, so it didn't have access to much moisture, not much water. So this contributed to how difficult it was for the Earth to revive. I'd never thought of this before, but Bannon pointed out now, at this time, we have an abundance of north-south coastlines, and that makes it a lot easier for species to kind of migrate as the conditions change. So that was kind of interesting. Another interesting note was that the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs, which, you know, people pretty much say, oh yeah, that's definitely the cause, and it's the extinction event that many of people are aware of, and in some ways was a little bit anomalous in the ways these events work, not just because of the asteroid. So the what happened wasn't just the asteroid. Other asteroids have hit the Earth and had very little effect beyond the local crater. But in this case, there was already significant volcanic activity going on the other side of the globe, no less, which was putting carbon into the atmosphere and warming things up. The asteroid, which earthquakes sometimes do, had the effect of kicking that activity into overdrive, speeded it up, and thus the fate of the large dinosaurs was sealed. Now, dinosaurs did survive in the form of birds, and they're still around. One more observation stood out for me about more current times. These days, the largest animals have gone extinct, and that can be laid squarely at humans' doorstep. That is, the mammoths, mastodons, the largest cats, giant tree sloths, and so on. In fact, much of the wildlife of Earth has died out. And this has been going on for centuries, and isn't just white European humans, but indigenous people as well. So the book makes for fascinating reading, and it's both scary and also somewhat reassuring. There are similarities to what's happening now, for sure. That's the scary part. Still, the Earth itself always survived. Bannon says, "And yet, despite this grim forecast, at this particular moment in geological history, we couldn't be luckier. Hundreds of millions of years still stretch before us on this planet. And the fact that we, that is humans, have survived all five major mass extinctions, that the Earth has managed to support life for billions of years without being destroyed, might be an almost miraculous circumstance. Squandering our good fortune would not be just a civilizational failing, but possibly a cosmologically important one." And yet again, he talks to this scientist, Peter Ward, who says, "Had Hale-Bopp hit us, there would not be any surface life on this planet." He was referring to the comet that provided a pleasant show in the night sky to Earthlings in 1997 and was four times the size of the asteroid that hit the Earth with the dinosaurs. And it would have sterilized the planet had its trajectory been slightly different. We're not just rare, we're lucky. Perhaps comets like Hale-Bopp hit planets like Earth all the time. The reason then that they haven't hit us, and strangely never have, is because on all the planets that do get hit, there's no one sitting around afterwards and wondering about it. This is the observer selection effect, and it has practical applications. If one were to try to estimate, for instance, the likelihood that a Hale-Bopp-sized rock will hit Earth in the near future, a seemingly logical first step would be to look at the geological record to see how often such massive craters appear in the Earth's past. Of course, this is hopeless because any planet with Earth-killing craters in the recent past wouldn't have observers in their wake to notice them. These unseen threats exist in an anthropic shadow, that's what they call it, censored by our very existence. Even if Earth-killing asteroids were exceedingly likely and hit planets like ours all the time, the only observers to ask questions about their likelihood would necessarily live on in those few planets with an exceptionally good run of luck dodging space rocks. And in a vast and possibly endless universe, plenty of such planets might exist. Estimates of our future survival and the future habitability of the planet are therefore biased by the fact that we're here to ask the question in the first place. Maybe our survival of all five major mass extinctions says less about the Earth's resilience than it does about the bias of our very existence and of the planet's astronomically good luck. Perhaps by the time I finish this sentence, this nearly impossible run of luck will have ended and will have been vaporized by a long overdue 100-mile-wide asteroid. Or perhaps, sometime soon, the eruptions of a truly world-ending continental flood basalt will begin to belch. The universe, it turns out, could be vastly more dangerous than we can possibly estimate based on our own, perhaps exceedingly lucky, past. Overconfidence becomes very large for very destructive events, Sandberg and his co-authors Nick Bostrom and Milan Cherkovich write in an unusually readable paper entitled Anthropic Shadow, Observation Selection Effects and Human Extinction Risks. Here's a sort of a summing up paragraph of this from this paper. As a consequence, we should have no confidence in historically based probability estimates for events that would certainly extinguish humanity. While this conclusion may seem obvious, it is not widely appreciated. The risks associated with catastrophes such as asteroidal or cometary impacts, supervolcanic episodes, and explosions of supernova gamma ray bursts are based on their observed frequency. As a result, the frequencies of catastrophes that destroy or are otherwise incompatible with the existence of observers are systematically underestimated. Okay. Where was I here? Yes. So what do we make of all this? How do we deal with it? It can seem overwhelming. What can one person do? So I'll leave that question for right now and move on to more personal disasters, those that seem maybe they're more possible to deal with. Several circumstances cause the end of life as we know it, if you think about it. Things like divorce, being fired from a job, a child leaving home, a cancer diagnosis, the death of a loved one, and so forth. In fact, lots of events cause this kind of ending, even extreme ending of our lives as we know them. I recall a former boss who was diagnosed with ALS, and she lived for quite a while, but eventually we got the notice that they were holding vigil at her house, with people coming over to work on a quilt. It was clear that it would be only a few days before she died. I went over for a while and spent some time, and then went downtown to run some errands, one of which was to Powell's bookstore. I had to park a ways away, and as I walked out on the street, I was hearing this particular mix of downtown summer sounds of construction, birdsong, and traffic, and enjoying the sunshine and the summer breezes. And it came to me that my friend would never, ever be able to experience this particular kind of day. After a few moments, I realized, in fact, that I wouldn't ever experience this particular day again either. In fact, you can make the case that every moment holds the end of life as we know it. The day that Kyogen died almost 5 years ago of a sudden, massive, unexpected heart attack was a horrendous day. Off he went to the hospital, and maybe a couple of hours later, I got the word that he had died and simply couldn't believe it. Several of us got things together to do a memorial service at the hospital, and at some point, Kakumyo and I came back to the office with the intention to eat lunch, maybe make some sandwiches to take to others holding vigil at the hospital, and to notify people who needed to be notified. I sat down at the computer and I found that I couldn't even figure out what to title this email to the Sangha. My first thought was something like unthinkable disaster, which is what I felt like at the time, so impossible to accept. Well, I knew this would not be a helpful title. So in the end, I settled for In Memoriam, which seemed like a ridiculously tame way to characterize an absolutely appalling fact. In fact, Kyogen's death was a disaster for the Sangha in many ways. On a mundane level, his name was on so many accounts, email lists, and so forth that it took a lot of time and a lot of effort to straighten them out. In a larger context, it shook our concept as a Sangha, who we are, our identity, direction, and vision. We were fortunate to have Kakumyo and Gyokuko at hand to take over abbacy and leadership, along with the rest of the staff, strong lay leadership, and a Sangha with a strong practice. Even so, it has taken some time to find our balance again. And yet, here we are, in this beautiful hall. Who knows where we would have been if Kyogen hadn't died when he did? It's useless to speculate. I like to think he would be pleased at how things have turned out. But again, that's speculation. It's a fiction on my part. Kyogen's death was one of the great tragedies of my life. The other being the death of my partner, the love of my life, 19 years ago. She died after 9 years of battling stage 4 breast cancer, which created uncertainty that characterized a large part of our relationship together. The only certainty was that we knew the disease would be fatal, but not when or how. We actually didn't know that until pretty much right up to the very, very end. We had what I called the gift of time, in that there were 9 years to get used to the fact. It's curious, though, that all of us live with the certainty of death and the uncertainty of when and how. We tend to ignore it as it's too difficult to wrap our heads around. Death is the great mystery. So many things about it are unknowable, unthinkable. We call it the great matter. During those 9 years, Pam and I talked a lot about death, trying to get a sense of what we were dealing with. When it came, her death was gentle, in the middle of the night, early on a Sunday morning, in a quiet hospital room with me by her side. But all that time of preparation didn't make it any easier for me to deal with the aftermath. That was, in many ways, just as devastating as when Kyogen died many years later. And have I learned anything about facing my own death or the deaths of anyone else around me? I'm not sure I have. My responses are still pretty similar to what I've always fallen back on: ignoring the whole thing, denial, keeping calm, and carrying on. It's not a bad strategy. Mostly works as well as anything, I suppose. And it's a little more comfortable for me than the other common response that happens with people, which is anger. I know many people who take a tragedy like the death of a loved one and turn it into a campaign to end cancer or heart disease, for example. There's nothing wrong with that, of course. One response looks passive, the other active. And our culture tends to value the active response more than the passive. But both contain elements of suffering to the extent that they don't deeply accept things just as they are. I've been talking with several people lately about aspects of the First Noble Truth, which says more or less that life is marked by dukkha, usually translated as suffering or dissatisfaction. Marked in this case means that suffering is an inevitable, inescapable fact of our lives, not just a temporary condition now and then. During one of these discussions, the subject of Mother Kali came to mind. Kali is a Hindu goddess associated with death and destruction. Here's some things I found out when I looked her up. Kali is the Hindu goddess or Devi of death, time, and doomsday, and is often associated with sexuality and violence, but is also considered a strong mother figure and symbolic of motherly love. Ah, there's an interesting contrast for you. Kali also embodies Shakti, feminine energy, creativity, and fertility, and is an incarnation of Parvati, wife of the great Hindu god Shiva. She's most often represented in art as a fearful fighting figure with a necklace of heads, a skirt of arms, a lolling tongue, and brandishing a knife dripping with blood. As an embodiment of time, Kali devours all things. She is irresistibly attractive to mortals and gods, and can also represent, particularly in later traditions, the benevolence of a mother goddess. Now there's that interesting contradiction again. One of the meanings of Kali's name is force of time. In this aspect, she is considered to stand outside the constraints of space-time and have no permanent qualities. She existed before the universe was created and will continue to exist after the universe ends. Limitations of the physical world, such as color, light, good and bad, do not apply to Kali. She is a symbol of Mother Nature herself, primordial, creative, nurturing, and devouring in turn, but ultimately loving and benevolent. In this aspect of goodness, she is referred to as Kali Ma, Mother Kali, or Divine Mother, and many millions of Hindus revere and worship her in this form. In tantric meditation, Kali's dual nature leads practitioners to simultaneously face the beauty of life and the reality of death with the understanding that one cannot exist without the other. So this allows me to look at another aspect of disasters, doomsdays, death, and destruction. Couldn't resist that alliteration. Peter Bannon, in his description of the ends of the world, notes that each of these eras of geological time has looked different from the others. That is, they built on what came before, but went in different directions. In fact, several different worlds have come into existence, thrived, and eventually died, as in fact, of course, do all things. So Lee Kump, head of the geosciences at Penn State, has some things to say. I just came across this a little while ago, so I wanted to mark it quite as easily. Okay, so, but before that, Bannon is summarizing the end Permian, which is the, you know, the really devastating one. To summarize, there was an ocean that was rapidly acidifying, one that over huge swaths of the planet was as hot as a jacuzzi and completely bereft of oxygen. There were sickly tides suffused with so much carbon dioxide and hydrogen sulfide that either poison would have sufficed as a killer in its own right. There was a Russian landscape detonating and being smothered in lava several miles deep. There was a fog of neurotoxins and lethal smog streaming from these volcanoes, and high above, an ozone layer blasted apart by halocarbons, inviting a bath of lethal radiation at the planet's surface. There was forest-destroying acid rain and a landscape so barren that rivers had stopped winding. There were carbon dioxide levels so high and global warming so intense that much of the Earth had become too hot even for insects. And now there were Kump's unearthly mega hurricanes made of poison swamp gas that would have towered into the heavens and obliterated whole continents. Given how outrageous some of these end Permian scenarios were, I asked Kump whether comparisons to the modern day are really appropriate. Well, he says, the rate at which we're injecting CO2 into the atmosphere today, according to our best estimates, is 10 times faster than it was during the end Permian. And rates matter. So today we're creating a very difficult environment for life to adapt. And we're imposing that change maybe 10 times faster than the worst events in Earth's history. That's the take-home message. He chuckled again. Not to be a doom and gloom guy. So that's the end of one chapter, and he goes on to the next, which is the end Triassic mass extinction. So he starts out this way. It's almost cheerful news that there would be still more mass extinctions in Earth's future. For anything unlucky enough to witness the unimaginable crescendo of the end Permian, it must have seemed certain that it would be the planet's last. But failing the complete sterilization of every last lagoon, cave, secluded pond, and deep-sea canyon on Earth, of even their most weedy and uninspiring inhabitants, the planet can survive. Indeed, in the wake of the major mass extinctions, it does more than survive. It blooms anew, which is eventually what it did, quite literally, in the Triassic. We saw this after Mount St. Helens. Those of you who are around and have been able to look up there, it looked like a complete moonscape. It was just completely wiped out. And somehow, not only did it just come back from there, it did. It bloomed abundantly. The Renaissance was born out of the Middle Ages because the Black Plague, which killed off a sizable portion of Europeans and opened up space for the great flowery of art, culture, and new political and economic systems. You could say that life cannot exist without death, and in fact, death is an integral part of life. And that's true, but it doesn't always help in figuring out how to deal with it when you're in the middle of experiencing its effects. Which brings me to compassion and caring. There is a way that deep acceptance of reality as it is has been seen as passivity and not caring. But one way to define compassion is from the literal roots, the literal root words, which is suffering with. It sees suffering and wants to relieve it. Our first bodhisattva vow says, "The beings are numberless. I vow to free them." So there is, in addition to deep acceptance, deep caring. Now, this is not the same as trying to fix the problem. Some problems are fixable and some are not. Suffering is not fixable in that sense. It is an inescapable part of our existence on this earth. The second noble truth says that suffering arises from grasping and aversion. That is, I want this, I don't want that. And too often our attempts to fix things come out of this desire, which just creates more suffering. The third noble truth, however, says that the end of suffering, nirvana, is possible, which seems to contradict the first noble truth, which I just said was that suffering is an inescapable part of our existence on this earth. The fourth noble truth says the way out of suffering is to follow the Eightfold Path, which talks about understanding, intention, effort, speech, action, livelihood, mindfulness, and concentration, which basically says how we live our lives matters. It isn't about fixing things. It's more about living harmoniously with everything around us, seeing things clearly, and taking wise action when it's called for. Simple, right? This is why we practice. Each of us has to find our own version of this noble path. What does wise understanding look like for me? What is my best action in this moment? How do mindfulness and concentration improve my ability to see clearly what needs to be done? I want to end with a story that I've told before, but which bears repeating. When my late beloved was in critical care in her last 3 weeks of life, at some point Gyokuko came to visit. We sat for about a half an hour together, and Pam slept. Gyokuko's presence changed the energy in the room a little bit. Finally, I said to her that keeping vigil by the bedside felt like being on sesshin, or a silent retreat. There were long periods of sitting, just kind of punctuated by getting up and doing stuff that needed to be done, and then more sitting. Gyokuko's response was to say, "Sesshin is practice. This is the real thing." So that's my talk for today. Questions or comments? Aha, over here. Okay, good. I think about it a little bit.
Thank you for your talk. It was very, with my background in geology, I really enjoyed it. But, you know, I thought about it a little bit, and you know, you talked about so many different dimensions and scales that it was almost overwhelming. But then I realized it really comes down to ourselves. I mean, that's the bottom line, and I think you drove that point home. And so I thank you, and it was a very good talk. Thank you.
It's really hard to get your head around those numbers. He did some stuff. One of the things he did in the book early on was to sort of try to give you a sense of what 500 million years looks like compared with our sense of time scales. I mean, we can't go much beyond, in our minds, we can't go much beyond about 2,000 or 3,000 years, maybe 5,000. Humanity is, you know, civilization's been around for maybe 10,000 years. So, you know, you talk about 500 million years, it's like that, you can't even grasp that. So, and he did some stuff to talk about, you know, the things that you do, kind of like comparisons, and it's kind of like, this is an eye blink, you know. Human life is an eye blink in geological time. So, but it sure is interesting, though, to look at that stuff. So, I think there was one over here.
I don't really understand this, but your talk has just made me feel immensely cheerful.
I had that experience as well, yes. I had that same feeling. It was kind of like, well, there's something kind of reassuring about it. You know, I don't, yeah, it's very interesting.
There's that old, not so old, pop song of recent decades. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
So, yeah, the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, there's a way that can work.
Thanks, Kenko. This talk was really awesome. I just appreciated, you know, the the two sides of destruction and creation and how they go together. And I also felt very hopeful, like, oh, 96% of life can die off and things will continue. Like, life will go on, life will find a way. So yeah, it's reassuring in that way, like being that I assume we are facing this next event, whatever that looks like. But it's also, I mean, it's, I'm sure many of us or all of us in this room are like really struggling with that or grappling with that and how we contribute to that or help it. And it's difficult to hold both things, like, okay, totally accept that this is fine and happening, and also like, yeah, and people are going to suffer a lot.
That's right. People and animals and plants.
Yeah,
and
yeah, there's going to be lots of suffering as that happens, and mm-hmm. and how do we hold all that?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of my biggest questions or koans that I have grappled with, and I've been aware of since I started practicing as a koan, is what is my responsibility? Or what Kyogen used to say, what is ours to do? And each of us has to figure out what that is. And it's not easy. I mean, there's not just a simple, straightforward, I mean, yeah, okay, we've got the Eightfold Path, but it's kind of vague, right? It's not just laying out, okay, now you're going to do this, and now you need to do that. There was a Facebook article not too long ago for Earth that somebody wrote about saying, you know, I don't care if you recycle. And, you know, her point was, do something, but it doesn't have to be anything in particular, and I'm not going to judge you about what you're doing, because it doesn't make sense to judge other people. Or, you know, we do. It's kind of like what Carl was saying. It comes down to my own, you know, what am I doing and what makes sense for me to do? How can I be the most effective and do what I need to do on this planet? Nobody can tell me that. And I can't tell you that. So, but I have grappled with it, because lots of people have opinions about what we should all be doing. And I have to stop and think, well, is that true? Or maybe I should, what? It's tricky.
Yeah, it is. And like, you know, when you're in a mindset of, I don't know, mundane, like, oh, this is, I'm just living my life and I'm doing what I need to do. But I think when we come face to like, oh, no, this is actually happening, then we reevaluate. But yeah, we're just operating in our sphere.
Yeah, you know, we don't want to get complacent, but on the other hand, we want to be really clear about the actions that we take. And that's not always easy.
Thanks.
Back here.
So this is sort of a follow-up. This is sort of a follow-up to the previous question. Are we sitting vigil at the bedside of dying ecosystems and species and ourselves? Mm. Are we trying to work to help them survive longer?
Mm. That's a very good question. And that is a question that comes up often for people who are working with the dying. You know, at what point does it make sense to just accept what's going on and be with what's going on? And at what point do we, you know, doctors face this dilemma all the time. It's kind of like, well, is this treatment likely to do any good, or is it just going to prolong suffering? And I don't think we're to that point yet. I mean, one of the things which I didn't get into is that sort of towards the end of the book, he's talking with various scientists, and it seems like most people agree we're not there yet. There's a tipping point that isn't clear. So, you know, we're not there, but we don't know for sure what it's going to take to get to the tipping point beyond which there's nothing more that can be done. But at this point, there's still some things that could be done. I think most of the scientists agree that there are some things that can be done. Whether any of those things will be done is a whole other question, right? And I don't know. I think each of us does what we can. But sitting vigil is actually a nice metaphor for what we have to do. We have to really, we need to stop and sit and listen and notice deeply. And I think, I think that's the center of it. Yeah.
I just wanted to say thank you for your talk. I mentioned once in your presence that I have a lot of anger about things that are happening to the climate, to the environment, and I can't fix that, but what you've said has given me some tools to start examining my own anger and thinking about it, which is separate from maybe taking action in the world, but it's still work I can do.
Yeah. I will say that at this point, my current, let's see, my current reactivity, perhaps, might be a good way to put it, is about the children in cages and the whole immigration stuff that's going on, and how, and I'm really starting to think, is there something I can do about that? Because I, and there may not be anything that I can actually do, but I'm feeling some urgency about that one. And I'm just still looking at that to see if something emerges that looks like it could be something that would be useful for me to do. There's certainly plenty of things on the planet that we can look at and say, that is horrendous. And mostly what I understand is that anger in and of itself doesn't generally help. I mean, the feeling, there's nothing wrong with the feeling of anger. That just comes up. But if you stay stuck with that and feed it, it actually causes you more harm than it does anybody else. And so that's why I say we need to be very clear as we can be about what is my responsibility, what is actually going to be helpful. And I don't know quite what to do beyond that. That's as close as I've come to figuring out what I need to do. So, got Gabe up here. Okay. I got Nate.
Okay. You just used the word urgency, and that made me think that's been a word that comes to mind to me. And kind of pretty quickly starts this cascade of feelings and responses. And I think it's interesting in the talk the way that you laid out the geological time, that sense of kind of ungraspable time.
Yeah.
And yet also that sense of urgency that goes along with what should my action be. And I don't know what question comes out of that, but that urgency thing is, I've been thinking about.
I know Gyokoko one time said that as soon as she hears herself thinking, I have to, that's a red flag. We actually had a post come across I think it was the SCBA list, I can't remember for sure, but from a priest who had this whole list of things that we must do as an organization. And I just looked at that list. And it wasn't like any of the things were bad. You know, it had to do with taking this kind of action, whatever. It was all fine. But that word must, I just thought, oh, honey. Boy, you know, and we must. Not even I must. We must. And I'm just sitting there going, I don't think so. That tells me that there's... And I get it. I get where that comes from, but it doesn't really work. We had a 7-Up discussion not too long ago about how did this go? It was sort of like this sense that people don't care about whatever. I think in this case it was about the children in cages, because they didn't do this. They didn't do a particular action. And people kind of went, well, wait a minute. That's one possible action, but it's not the way I act in the world. And I don't think you can say that people don't care because they don't do what you want them to do. I just don't think you can do that, right? So this is why we have to be careful about this stuff, with urgency. You know, I'm kind of noticing the urgency and thinking, uh-huh, that's interesting. I pay attention to it because it may at some point become, When I know the thing that needs to be done, it doesn't feel urgent. It just feels natural. It feels like, of course, that's what I'm going to do. So the urgency, it might be leading in a direction, but it's not the thing.
Thank you.
Thanks for your talk, Inka.
He'll come back to you. It's okay. It's okay.
I was first.
Very, very expressive there.
So this whole notion about the end of the world as we know it, it's got me thinking about how many times the end of my life as I knew it has come and gone, and including a 10-year stint in the joint. It's just never as bad as my head tells me that it's going to be.
Right.
And in fact, I mean, there's a bright side to all this because every time my world has ended, it's ended for the good. The events that may have happened were painful and difficult and all kinds of stuff, but it's always been for the good, including the loss of my mother. She suffered for 15 years, and when she left, it brought our family into a unit that it hadn't been, and which is what she wanted. So even with that, it was, which in my short time here in this part of the Sangha, I've seen that since Kyogen's passing. So there's an upside to this end of the world business. That's
it's true.
I just want to put that out there.
It is true. Just part of my point here. And Sherman.
I've been thinking recently about sort of the catastrophe slowed down, which is like global warming and associated weather issues. And historically, I've kind of looked at it and I'm going, damn, I'm not going to live long enough to see these things happen. But they're happening.
Right.
I mean, and people all over the earth are finally going, shit, this stuff is happening.
Right.
And it's too bad it's happening from a lot of points of view, but there will be positive responses too. So that's all.
There is something about the knowledge that I'm not going to live long enough to see XYZ. You know, I mean, I think we start thinking about it when we get to this point in our lives where it starts becoming really clear that, you know, in many ways, this problem is not going to be a problem that is going to affect my life so much as it is future generations. Which doesn't mean that it's not my problem, but it changes my relationship to it some. Yeah. It's another one hard to wrap your head around. You know where it is. Do we have another one back here? Is that one? Aha, there you are.
Yeah, just to tack on to what Nathan has said, it's the end of the world has happened to me, and of course there was an 8-month sentence associated with it. I miss parts of my old life, but I like parts of my new life, and I don't know that I would say that one is better than the other. In a sense, I can say, boy, what an interesting ride.
Yeah.
And I've seen some things that not too many people get to see, and I've been places not too many people get to see, and at least I've experienced. And yeah, I've lived two lives, probably more than two. But
oh yeah, no, I can't count the number of lives I've lived. But one thing I do want to say is that I don't think you've missed any part of your life. All of what you've done is part of your life. And the trick is to stay with that, is to know that this was my life, this is my experience. So I am not, even though I am Kyogen's student, I am not Kyogen. Kyogen went into the monastery when he was in his 20s. I came to this practice when I was close to 50. So I have a very different background. And I have sometimes felt, well, but I haven't done all that scholarly, you know, reading and study and really immersing myself into it for all those years and decades. But I bring other things to this situation, to my position, if you will. And it all fits. It all works. It's all a part of my practice and what I bring. And I think that's true for all of you, you know. So you didn't miss anything. The only way we miss out is by not paying attention or by somehow saying this doesn't count, because it all counts. It all counts.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's. I miss my children.
That's
when I say missing something, that's
yes,
essentially what
I see what you're saying, yes. And yeah, that is a difficulty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to help take the edge off sometimes, there is this excellent triple Belgian style ale called The End of the World, La Fin du Monde. And it is excellent.
Okay, then. We got it over here.
So some years ago, I had a dream where somebody said to me, the world is ending. What is the point of you doing all this Zen shit? And I was like, I don't know, that seems like why I'm doing it. Like, if anything was going to motivate me to do it, maybe that would be a thing. This whole conversation sometimes gets very grim. And sometimes I wonder with my practice, should I be getting ready? What should I be getting ready for? The world seems to be rapidly accelerating, not just in climate change, but it all seems to be kind of a unified push with authoritarianism and genocide and you know, I wonder, you know, it's like all the things that we sometimes see in like other places that where the violence is like far away, that those things will come here and maybe in the not too distant future. And so this question comes up again, is like, you know, I think you said earlier about like, is there things to be done, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I wonder, it's like, should the thing that I, you know, I'm like, should I be getting ready?
Yeah, getting ready or preparing is, it's interesting. So one of the things that I mentioned in here was this contrast between what happened with Pam and what happened with Kyogen. So with Pam, theoretically, we spent a lot of time getting ready. And that was fine. It was good. But it didn't ultimately make it that much easier to get through it. With Kyogen, there was no getting ready, really. It was just sort of, bam, there we are. Like, what? The way I understand this is that we get ready by practicing and being attentive to what's going on in our lives. So I talked with a fellow once who evidently he's had some experiences of near-death experiences. And he had one where he kind of came up to it and he thought, oh, well, that's just the next step. It was very simple. which I found reassuring. It was kind of like, oh, okay, so I don't have to worry so much. Basically, if you're here, if you know how to sit, if you know how to pay attention and just face the next moment, whatever it is. So if the thing about getting ready and preparing a lot of times creates expectations and plans, it's going to look like this. And guess what? It probably won't. So what we have to learn to do is to be able to be completely open to whatever's coming up. I'll tell you, you know, this business of living different lives, I mean, stuff happens, things change in ways that I couldn't imagine sitting here 5 years ago. I don't know that I would imagine sitting here 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I mean, it's just, I could not have put myself here. I could not have put myself here. There has something else been going on that is out of my control. And for the most part, our lives are out of our control. So what we do is we practice, we live the best we can, we take responsibility as clearly as we can, we do all this stuff that I just sort of mentioned here at the end that sounds simple and isn't, and keep practicing with that so that at the moment of a disaster, the end of life as we know it, whatever that looks like, we can simply be there with it, whether it's sitting vigil or taking some kind of action. And that's really what it's about. It's real life. Yeah. Okay. Last call. I think Nancy has managed to put lunch together for us. Susanna has helped put, so they're pointing at each other, and Shoke helped, and Ember got it all together at the beginning. It's been a definite work collaborative process today. But I think we have lunch, and so let us go and enjoy it. Thank you so much for your kind attention.